Mr. Gorbachev, tear down this wall.
We maintain the peace through our strength. Weakness only invites aggression.
Trust but verify.
Well, I've said it before and I'll say it again. America's best days are yet to come.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
On this episode of Reaganism, Roger is joined by Congressman Will Hurd. Congressman Hurd, a Republican, was elected in 2014 to represent the 23rd Congressional District of Texas. Before being elected, Representative Hurd served as an undercover officer in the Central Intelligence Agency. Roger and Representative Hurd discussed the congressman's time in the CIA, lessons he has learned from winning close elections in a politically split district, and his perspective on law enforcement reform as the lone Black Republican in the U.S. House of Representatives. If you enjoy the conversation, please subscribe to Reaganism on YouTube, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever else you listen to shows. And remember to write us a review. We hope you enjoy the conversation.
Congressman Will Hurd, welcome to the Reaganism Podcast. Great to have you here.
Hey, brother, it's good to be on. I don't know why it's taking so long for you to have me on, but hey, we did it.
You know, we're just getting started here. We had to work our way for the cream of the crop, you know? And you've got so much going on and leading voice in the Congress on so many issues. You and I got to know each other working on national security issues, but that's only one place where you have such an important voice in the U.S. Congress. We'll talk about all that. But for our listeners, you know, give us a little bit about your background. There's a quote that my colleague Keegan Sweeney found in a profile written about you when you made the decision to leave the CIA to run for Congress. It's not a quote from you, it's from your brother. Yeah. This is great. It reminded me of something my brother might have said. On this decision, he said, referring to you, Congressman Will Hurd, you could have done anything you wanted, but he went from dealing from one set of terrorists and thieves to dealing with another set of terrorists and thieves. Sounds like your family supported this decision.
Yeah, this is a long history of me making decisions my family didn't support. When I first decided to get into the CIA, you know, I was right out of undergrad, and to get to that point, right? To get to that point, my degree was computer science, and I thought I was going to be a programmer somewhere, and I had never been outside of Texas. Asterisk. I had been to Langston, Oklahoma, which is basically like Texas.
Isn't that part of Texas?
Yeah. I had been to Indiana as a young boy. I don't remember it. And I went and toured Stanford's campus when I was in college because I was going to go there. And I'd never left campus. So I'm walking across. It's my freshman year at Texas A&M University. I see a sign that says take 2 journalism classes in Mexico City for $425. And I had $450 in my bank account. So I go to Mexico, right? Fell in love being in another culture, reading about things I'd only read about in books. Like, you know, I went to like the pyramid of the sun, right? And you're like, holy mackerel, this is amazing. But you're like, wait a minute. This isn't the Aztecs built this? We don't know who built the pyramid of the sun. We don't know what those people called it. Like, the Aztecs found the Pyramid of the Sun 1,000 years after it was built. Like this stuff just blew my mind. And so I added international studies as a minor. In the first class I took, I had this old school guest lecturer, Cold Warrior, CIA tough guy, right? His name's Jim Olson. And he was the head of counterintelligence, was involved in the Aldrich Ames, you know, capture, all that stuff. And he told these stories and I was like hooked, right? And that began my interest in CIA. And so long-winded setup to this point of the story, I tell my father and my mother knew I was going to CIA. And I had also gotten a job, an offer from IBM. And my offer from IBM was 3 times the salary I was gonna be making as a GS-7 step 5 in government. And my dad was... Yeah. My dad was horrified of my decision. And he's like, boy, I don't want to come home one day and my house blow up. Right. And I'm like, if that's your biggest concern, Pops, we're going to be okay. So I've been you know, not living up to my family's expectations for a long time.
So you go from the CIA, turning down IBM, and then you migrate from the CIA to the U.S. Congress, another unconventional or unusual step. You know, you're an agent working in Pakistan, not disclosing anything that hasn't been disclosed publicly already. Sure. And then you find yourself on the floor of the U.S. Congress. What did you see in, I don't know, it was Islamabad or some other spot that you said, I got to come back and leave the Congress?
Look, so I was what's called, old school guys call it a case officer. The technical term is operations officer. So I was the guy responsible for collecting intelligence. I was the guy recruiting spies and selling secrets. And because I came straight out of undergraduate, and we only take a really small group of people that do that, I was in DC in training a little bit longer than the clandestine service trainees, the CSTs, right? And so I started, literally I drove my Forerunner from San Antonio to Washington, DC, the day of the USS Cole bombing, right? The USS Cole, the US naval destroyer in the Gulf of Aden off the coast of Yemen. And I remember this was back in the day when you were pumping gas and there'd be like a little TV there. And I remember pumping gas and seeing this. And I'm like, whoa, I'm getting ready to join the CIA. I wonder if I'm going to know anything about this. Fast forward like 3 weeks.
Oh, did you?
I'm on the freaking Yemen account, right? I'm like literally fresh off the boat, you know, dealing with Yemen. Yeah, it was crazy. I went to Aden. I went to Sana'a. I went to the capital of Yemen. I didn't go to Aden. And so it was a great job. And so in addition to collecting intelligence and being in dark places and dangerous places at 4 o'clock in the morning, I also had to brief members of Congress, right? And I was pretty shocked by the caliber of some of our elected leaders.
These are the congressional delegations coming in and overseas you're talking
about? Yeah, absolutely. You know, the HPC codels. You know this, Roger, right? Like you know, it is. These are members of Congress, most of the times that are serving on the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence. Or appropriations, sometimes appropriators would be allowed, and you would have to brief them for a number of issues. And you know, I tell a story about what happened when I was in Afghanistan, but a story I haven't told that often was when I was in India. And you this was after the tsunami in 2000, this would have been 2004, 2004, 2005. And that tsunami literally killed hundreds of thousands of people in South Asia. There was a bipartisan, bicameral group of members of Congress come over, and they were getting ready to give a brief. They were getting ready to do a you know, with our colleague, the congressional colleagues from the Indian Parliament, and it was a briefing right before they were going out. And a member of Congress raises his or her hand and says, I don't know what all the hubbub is about, uses the word hubbub, because I thought based on their religion that when they die this way, they come back as a tree or a flower, and that's what they want. And you're like, okay, you're not allowed to speak at the podium, right? And then you fast forward to like Afghanistan, bomb goes off in front of the embassy, takes out a section of our protective wall, kills some of the local guards. My unit was responsible for figuring out what happened. We conduct a couple dozen operations. We had a HPC codel that night, congressional delegation. And I'm walking in the briefing, and the first thing somebody says is the CIA going to cut this briefing short so we can get to the bazaar to buy rugs, right? I'm annoyed, right? But whatever, we go in the briefing, and a senior person who had been on the committee for 5 years says, ask the question, this is 2008, why was Iran not supporting the Taliban in Afghanistan the way Iran was supporting other groups in Iraq? Okay, and for those of y'all listening, Roger just made a weird face because this is actually a pretty basic question that you would not expect someone who'd been on the House Permanent Select Committee on Intelligence for 5 years asked. So I started explaining the Sunni-Shia divide. And the same member says, Will, what's the difference between a Sunni and a Shia? And I'm thinking he's getting ready to make a really inappropriate joke. And who am I to deny this member of Congress the opportunity to make a joke? And so my response was, I don't know, Congressman, what's the difference? And I'm getting ready to go, but I'm bump bump, right? His face goes bright red. Didn't know that difference in Islam, right? It's okay for my brother not to know that because he's a salesman in San Antonio. But for someone who's making those decisions on sending our boys and girls and men and women into tough places or how to spend billions of dollars, it's unacceptable. And so that's why, and that's a long-winded story. I apologize for the long-winded telling, Roger. But that's why I decided to run for Congress. And so I left a job I loved after 9.5 years, moved back to my hometown of San Antonio, ran for Congress, and then lost the runoff by 700 votes. So I'm glad I don't tell that story anymore.
Yeah, well, I mean, so you don't make things easy for yourself because you go from literally the hotspots in the world, our greatest national security challenges, and then you pick a district that basically requires 24 hours a day, 365 days a year attention. I mean, your races are decided by less than 1,000 votes. Give us a sense of the district and partisanship and Texas and what it just says about the challenge you faced running for office, but also the country writ large.
So the 23rd Congressional District of Texas is 29 counties, two time zones, 820 miles of the border. It takes 10 and a half hours to drive from one corner of the district to the other at 80 miles an hour, which is actually the speed limit in a lot of the districts. It is, since 2016, has flipped back and forth, RD, RD, RD. I'm the first to hold it three cycles in a row. And it's a 71% Latino district. And so every issue imaginable is in the 23rd. And to be frank, I ran in 2009 for the 2010 election. One of the reasons, one, this is basically where I grew up, but it was a district that a dark horse candidate like me could win if you spend time, energy, and effort and put energy into it. And you know, I tell people, a third of my district doesn't have cell phone service. And sometimes there's more cows than people in the middle part of the district. And so, but I wish more districts across the country were like mine. That's where it's truly 50-50. And, you know,
why do you wish that?
The only way in our country we've been able to solve problems is by doing it together, right? This concept that unified government, that really over the last 10 or 15 years, that the only way to govern is unified government, meaning the same political party in the White House, Senate, and the House, right? That has not been the case over the history of our country. And we usually are able to govern and work together, right? And when you work together, those things stick, right? You know, the major piece of legislation that have been bipartisan has stuck. And that's what's great. And so to me, the competition of ideas should happen in November, not in March in Texas's case, which is when our primary is, right? Primary dates are different across the country. And so if more districts were 50-50 and that competition of ideas was in November, we would be better off. And if you look at the 2020 cycle, 40 seats are competitive. But if you go back 20 years, you probably had about 100 and, you know, almost about 100 seats. 10 years before that, about 150. 10 years before that, you know, over 175, right? And so if more districts were 50-50, I think you would see, and I get rewarded for solving problems. And right, the way you win elections now is by creating contrast. And so if I win an election by creating contrast, guess what am I always doing? Creating contrast, right? And so I think that, and that's why I love the 23rd, right? The 23rd is not like that. It's the exact opposite.
So we're going to get to this at the end, but one more question on this point, and then I want to talk about your role in the Republican Congress right now, the Republican conference, is to say. But is it alienating to be a member who has to really kind of be in a 50-50 district? And, you know, as you said, you're trying to get stuff done, you know, you didn't use the word compromise, but I think it's what you're implying, that you got to compromise, you got to seek some sort of agreement, consensus. Whereas the other members, either members in your own party, members in another party, where it's not 50-50, they're using the institution as a platform, like what Yuval Levin, you know, has written about, and they're not trying to get stuff done. I mean, how do you coexist with the members who are in the 50-50 space and those that are in an 80-20 district?
It's so this is why there's a lot of friction, right, in getting things done. And so, look, for me, it's real simple. My philosophy is this. The president of the United States is not my boss. The speaker of the House is not my boss. The leader of my party is not my boss. My bosses are the 800,000 people that I represent, right? And I've been empowered by them to come solve problems, come to Washington, D.C. to solve problems for them. And so for me, I agree with people when I agree with them. I disagree with them. I disagree with them. And it's unfortunate that phrase, that word compromise, has almost become a four-letter word. And part of it is the way we negotiate in Washington, D.C., in my opinion, is backwards. I say we negotiate through subtraction rather than addition. What do I mean by that? One side will say, I want these 100 things. And the other side says, no. And so you whittle it down to like 12 things. And then you're like, what happened to the other 78 things, right? And you felt like you left so much on the table instead of starting with, hey, I want this one thing. Okay, the equivalent of that one thing are three things on my side. Well, I don't think that's the case. Let me add two more. And so when you build up to the 12, then it becomes a win-win and it's a victory, right? And so that's how, when I was in the private sector, you would negotiate contracts. And unfortunately, in Washington, D.C. right now, it's everybody wants to beat their chest. And the old notion, you know, I when I first came involved in politics, I was told good policy is good politics. That may not always ring true right now in this time.
So we'll get back to this in a bit. But, you know, we're obviously having this conversation amidst the pandemic, amidst protests across the country. With the killing of George Floyd, and really important discussions around race in this country. You are the only Black Republican in the House of Representatives. You have an important and unique voice. And, you know, fortunately for all of us, you've given us opportunity to hear you of late. I want to talk about that, and specifically just being in a Republican conference as the only Black Republican. You know, tell us what that's like, and why is it that way?
Why is it that way? Look, it's a really good. I wish I was a proper historian and could say why. Right? When you go back to, we all know, you know, my father always says, my father's 87-year-old Black man. My mother is white. And my dad always says, he's like, I've been a Republican since Lincoln freed us, right? And then you look at what Ulysses S. Grant, who is completely underrated as a president, the things that he's done for our country and the African-American community. And when you look at, you know, some of the Jim Crow laws and things that happened, those were actually Democratic laws back then. How we have gotten to this point, I wish I could do better, say why we are where we are today. But one of the problems that we have is, and this is not me complaining, this is just statement of fact. When any Republican says anything crazy, every other Republican has to answer to that. And so there are Republicans that have said racist, misogynistic, anti-Semitic, homophobic things. Right. And unfortunately, the entire party gets painted with that brush. And then we don't do enough to take our message to communities of color. And so if we did a better job of engaging folks, and you can't engage, if you try to engage somebody 3 months before an election, that's called pandering. Right. You have to have a prolonged effort. And so what I have done, like when I go to communities along the border, that literally in a primary, the first primary, there's a Eagle Pass is on the border. The county is Maverick County. In 2009 Republican primary, there were 27 Republican primary voters, right? Now in the general election, it was the fourth largest county, right? And so a lot of times Republicans just didn't go. Mm. But hell, I showed up, right? And literally the first time I went, there was a party, it was an afternoon party, about 700 people. And I had 212 people come up to me and ask me, why was I there? Now, what I call the professional political class, campaign consultants and pollsters would say, you know, well, these are Latinos and they're probably Catholic and Catholics are pro-life. You should talk about your pro-life, you know, experiences. Like, no. My answer was real simple. I'm here because I like to drink beer and eat barbecue too, right? And then they kind of laughed. And the second time I showed up, people would actually shake my hand. Third time I showed up, people would walk by and be like, I'm a Republican, right? And then the fourth time they'd tell me a problem. Fifth time I'd come back and say, hey, this is how I solved it, right? And so my numbers in that community, like, were drastically improving. And one of the reasons why I've been able to survive and thrive, to be honest, in a district like this, because I engage. Now, I don't engage just because I have melanin in my skin. I engage because it's the right thing to do. And so at every level of government, we need more Republicans going into communities and engaging them. We need to be engaging, you know, women with a college degree that live in the suburbs. We need to be talking to people under the age of 29. And we need to be talking about issues that they care about. And oftentimes we come in with some complicated macroeconomic theory. And it's like, no. People care about food on the table, roof over their head, and the people that they love being healthy and happy. Focus on those things, right? And this is where I criticize some of the think tanks and stuff too, because let's articulate how our policies in recent times has helped. We always just wanted, you know, right now under the current administration, you know, unemployment for African Americans is the lowest it's ever been. Okay, great. We need to be able to talk about more things, right? We should be talking more about how school choice in Texas has led to Latinos having better test scores by far, right? Versus people in other schools, right? Like there's data for that. And so we need to be taking a more nuanced message. Anyway, I'm babbling a little bit here about this, but this is some of the issues.
Yeah, no, it's getting to engagement. I mean, it's a very kind of applied set of examples of how you engage. And I mean, you've said that if the Republican Party doesn't start looking like America, there won't be a Republican Party in America. And I think, you know, that fairly provocative, yet you know, probably sound insight, the way you address that is by engaging. And of course, you know, one of the ways you're engaging right now is the response to George Floyd's killing and you know, the discussion, at least at the federal level, of law enforcement reform. You wrote about 10 days ago or so, a really, I thought, excellent and important opinion piece in the Wall Street Journal about George Floyd and about what you would be advocating in the Congress. But you started that by sharing personal experience and one that has come up a lot across the Black community in terms of what it's like to be a young Black man getting behind the wheel, and how your father essentially trained you.
Yeah. Look, my dad, I think in the piece I said I was 15, but I think I was 14, because in Texas, we're allowed to get our learner's, or we used to back then get our learner's permit when we were 15, right? And so I was always pushing the envelope. And my dad said, if I ever get pulled over by the police, you know, turn your radio off, turn the light in the car on so everybody can see inside, roll your window down, put your hands on the window seal, and don't make a move unless you tell the police officer what you're going to do. Sir, if you need my license, it's in the right pocket of my pants. I need to reach with my right hand to get to my right pocket. And then don't do that until the officer says okay, right? And And it's you know, if you talk to folks in the African-American community, especially men, you'd be like, you know, your dad had to talk. A lot of people talk about, you know, the talk being about the birds and the bees. A lot of times it's how you deal with the police. And so what has happened, and what's been, I told that story because one of my staffers was like, oh my God, that's just, why did you have to do that? And I've had people respond to me telling this now, be like, well, I told the same thing to my daughter. And my response to that is simple. You told that to your daughter because she was going to be upset that she was going to get in trouble. My dad told it to me because he thought it would save my life, right? And that's the big difference. And so what is unique about this point and where we are now, and I think why George Floyd is such an important part in our history, nobody who saw that video thought that anything that happened in there was okay, right? And you had video and audio. And the fact that he called out to his mother who had already passed away, right? And you know, this made people like, whoa. And the how cavalier that officer was, kneeling on his neck with his hand in his pocket, right? People are stopping and being like, whoa, what is really going on? And so, you know, there's a people are asking these questions. So that's why being able to talk about it a little bit more. You know, even little things, right? Like if you ask any Black person, how many times has somebody ever asked to touch your hair? It would be probably dozens, if not hundreds, right? And it seems like it's like I would never talk to a stranger or someone I didn't know and be like, can I touch your hair? Because it's so unique. Like these are little things. And my parents live in the home that they live in now, and they've lived there my entire life, 43 years, because no other place in town would sell to an interracial couple. So my mom would go look at houses, and my dad was a traveling salesman, so he was gone most of Monday through Thursday or through Friday. And then my mom would see a house, like, okay, my husband's coming home and he wants to see it. And they would go on a Saturday, and the realtor would be like, it's been sold, right? Now, the place where we ended up living, when they bought it, it was in the boonies. And the school that I ended up going to was a good public school.
Because that was the only imagine. House. I mean, they were out in the boonies because that was a place that someone would sell to them.
They would sell it to them, right? And so imagine this, right? At that time, the places with the best school district, my parents couldn't move into. They had the money, they had the willingness, but they couldn't. So that deprived us potential access to the best schools in those areas, right? And so these are the long-term ramifications. Well, now that's not happening now, right? But the ramifications of those previous decisions. And so I think these are some of the conversations that people are having now. And what was interesting, I marched in Houston to show solidarity with George Floyd's family, about 60,000 other folks from Texas. And it was peaceful. The police was handing out water bottles to the marchers. And you had all shapes and sizes, all colors, right? Like it really, I was shocked at how many non-Blacks were there.
No, right? I saw your tweet. You tweeted live from there, or you put something out. It was
amazing. And for me, it was what was happening at that moment. People were outraged by a Black man dying by a white officer in police custody. They were glad law enforcement was there enabling our First Amendment rights. And they were outraged by criminals taking advantage of these protests and looting and rioting and killing officers after the protests.
All three things going on at once.
And that's okay. You can feel all of those emotions at the same time. And it's okay, right? And that's one of the things that I took away from that march. And hopefully, right, that feeling of being upset or concerned about all these things. This is not about, you know, look, the debate, you know, we support law enforcement. This notion of defunding the police is crazy because it's going to lead to less safe communities. Nobody wants that, right? But we can make sure we have the best standards of police departments across the country.
So you've been talking about this a bit. I mean, so, you know, you go from that march, those mix of emotions articulated, you know, really well, just capturing that moment. But you are that member of Congress, right? You are the one Black Republican in the House of Representatives in the Republican Conference. And now you're back in the nation's capital, and there's, what are we going to do about this? And for the federal level, it's about law enforcement reform. And so now, you know, 10 days, 15 days later, whatever it is, you're in the center of this debate, and you've just articulated where you stand on a major fault line, this defund the police, or what you've emphasized, training, spending more to train police. There are other things out there, whether we should, Congress should prohibit use of chokeholds or no-knock warrants for drug-related cases, or this notion of qualified immunity. What are you emphasizing? And give us a little bit of insight into this moment in legislative craft, different factions, parties debating, negotiating, and whether it's politics as usual, or are you seeing something different? So both on the substance, but also the process here, Will. And then I know we'll shift to another part of the discussion before we close out.
Sure. So let's start with, if I could do two things. First is, you have groups like CALEA, the Commission for the Accreditation of Law Enforcement Agencies, that are police officers, these from all walks of life, that talk about what is the best standard in how you teach de-escalation. What is the best standard in dealing with someone who has a mental health issue? What is the way you respond to somebody who's drunk, right? How you should handle people when they're handcuffed, right? Like we can come up with the best standards and how policing works, but unfortunately, that level of training is not the same across police departments across this country. How can we incentivize police departments to use those best practices? And to me, it's with federal grants that are already being given, right? And so let's improve the standards across all those. Let's find that standard body, use it. That's one. Two, making it easier for a police chief to fire a bad cop. Period, end of story, right? And usually a police officer fires a cop, it goes through adjudication, and then 46% of the time that cop gets put back on the force, right? It's crazy.
If they get fired, if they go through that adjudication process, which just from the way you've described it seems onerous and difficult, 46% of the time that same officer will find that way back onto the force.
The same force that the chief of police thought it was necessary to fire that person for. It's crazy, okay? And guess what? Police chiefs, good cops, they know who the bad cops are. They don't want to work with them. So I feel like it's our responsibility to help make sure those bad cops are taken away because the good cops don't have. Oh, and by the way, a lot of times their records are expunged after 2 years. So any previous grievances that they had are flushed from those records, right? So those two things would put us in a better position to prevent another Black man from dying the way George Floyd died, right? So now how do we get there? We were able to pass three colossal pieces of legislation and get them signed into law dealing with COVID-19 pandemic because the negotiations began in a bicameral, bipartisan fashion. Reforming policing did not happen that way. Democrats introduced their bill. They've introduced it already. They have 220 co-sponsors, which means they don't have to take input from Republicans. We're going to have
you don't need any Republican votes once you have 220 co-sponsors. That's your point.
Absolutely. And so are we going to make it to where it's overwhelmingly bipartisan? And having private conversations with everybody involved in that, there's a lot of agreement on things that we can do, right? And so I also think that the rhetoric around this has been tame compared to rhetoric around other pieces of legislation, but we'll see over the next 2 weeks. And I think in the House, this is gonna go to judiciary. When it comes out of judiciary, I think that will be the time in which potential changes are made. I'm hopeful where Republican amendments can get added or at least get votes on the floor that I think can make this a stronger bill. You have the president issuing his executive order, and then you have a Senate version. And whether in the next couple of weeks we can all get on the same page and not let politics get in the way. You know, I try to have it. My dad always taught me to have a PMA, a positive mental attitude. I'm trying to stay positive because in the conversation I've had, there's a lot of overlap on how we can get there.
So I want to jump to your future, and then we'll do our lightning round. But before we leave this subject, you know, just hearing you describe your activities the past couple of weeks and your deep and important thinking on this issue, do you feel that the Republican conference and more broadly the Congress is giving you is taking your voice and taking your point of view into account adequately?
Oh, for sure. There's no doubt about that. And look, Kevin McCarthy, I consider him a friend, and he's always, you know, wanted me to be more outspoken and play his role. So look, I also here's the deal, right? I'm going to give my opinion, right? Whether some folks like it or not. And I'm going to be honest, and I'm going to always try to work towards a solution. And so, I've made my opinions known.
And that was always the case, but probably, especially so now that you will not be seeking reelection. Mm-hmm. There will be a new member of Congress representing the 23rd district, a congressional district of Texas. That was a blow to all of your fan club, Will. And I think anybody listening to this conversation, will share that view. Just take a few minutes, explain to everybody why now was the time to leave. Obviously, it's a grueling lifestyle, particularly to get reelected in your district. So that's understandable. You went from the CIA to the U.S. Congress. What's the next painful thing you plan to do with your life?
So, look, I appreciate the kind words. And just like I left the CIA because I thought I could help the intelligence community a different way, I feel like I can help the country a different way, right? I've always said that these jobs being in Congress are not designed to be in it for 30 years. I think I'm at 16 pieces of the legislation signed the law, 15 or 16, probably a couple more before it's over. That's more legislation than most people get signed in law over a 20, 30 year career. So legislatively, I'm pretty proud of my three terms in Congress. There was in a book that I like about Ronald Reagan, I don't know if this is Ronald Reagan said it, or if this was the author of the book saying this about Ronald Reagan. It was like, listen, lead, and then leave, right? And so for me, the opportunity to do stuff in media, to talk about the issues I care about, that interconnection of technology and national security, is going to be exciting. And working on projects like a Anthony Bourdain-style show on technology is going to be fun. To be able to be in the private sector and work on the cutting edge of artificial intelligence. Vladimir Putin said, whoever masters AI masters the world, right? And I don't agree with anything Vladimir Putin said, except for probably that statement. And so there's no second place when it comes to AI. And having been involved in this on the legislative side and the policy side, to be able to help do this with the people that are designing these algorithms, like that's gonna be exciting. Also working with in academia on building an institute on technology and policy. I want to get that poli-sci, you know, major who gets a data sciences minor and then help them become and understand both sides of the policy and the technology so that we have those people in Washington, D.C. shaping the environment for us to make sure that we continue to have the strongest economy in the world. And then politically, I'm staying involved. I'm helping candidates across the country, you know, in difficult primaries to make sure that we have that Republican Party that looks like America. So I'm looking forward to doing those things, staying involved and working on these issues that I've cared about since in my time in Congress.
But there's a possibility in the future you'll return to public office. You know, that it's a nice challenge to have before you next, but you're not writing that off entirely, right?
Like I'm 42 years old, and if the sun, the rain, the moon, the stars, and the mountains align again, then yeah, I'll evaluate it. And if I have a chance to serve my country again that way, then of course I'll think about it. But there's so many ways to serve, and I've enjoyed my time in Congress. And guess what? I'm going to run through the tape. In these final 5 or 6 months, however long it is.
No doubt. We're going to go to our lightning round. This is where we ask
you've emphasized lightning a few times, Roger. I'm a little verbose.
I have your chief staff pinging me right now. Like, you're supposed to let him go 15 minutes ago.
Yeah.
Either your favorite book about President Reagan, your favorite speech by President Reagan, your favorite President Reagan quote, one, two, or all three. What do you got?
Gotcha. Okay. Favorite book. I'm curious if you know this one. Reagan's Comeback by Gilbert Garcia.
I'm a fail. I got to retire or just leave. I have never heard of it. Wow.
Look, it's a great book. It's written by, it's a reporter from San Antonio, and it's about the 1976 primary in Texas and how Reagan won that. And it goes through that that process and what's fascinating, right? And I read this book in between when I lost in 2009 but before I won in 2014. And what's wild is a lot of those people that helped Ronald Reagan in 1976 were people that were helping me.
Come on.
In 2014, right? It's an amazing how they pulled that off, right? It's a wonderful book. Another good one is The Greatest Communicator by Dick Wortham. You know, his longtime political
writer and aide, yeah.
Strategist, right? And one of my favorite things from that is persuade through reason and motivate through emotion, right? That's great. And a great speech is his 1980 acceptance speech at the Republican nomination for president. And while he was there accepting the nominee, as a Republican, he was already talking about Democrats and painting a vision of what the future should be, and that way more united us than divided us. Right? That's something that I firmly believe in. And the quote I often use from Ronald Reagan is, "Freedom is never more than one generation away from extinction, and man is not free unless government is limited." Having lived overseas in places that didn't have freedoms, that didn't have rule of law. This is something that has resonated with me.
You killed the lightning round. That was amazing. No other guest has done that. I mean, there were two unique references that I am disappointed to say I had not heard of, but we'll check out. And the 1976 primary is a great one. What people don't really know about President Reagan, but actually one of the most consequential things he did. Congressman Will Hurd, it's been awesome having you on the Reaganism podcast. We look forward to having you back at some point in the future in whatever amazing new activity you're up to. So really, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, brother, enjoyed it.